Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hi, listeners. I'd like to invite you to visit our website at organicgardenerpodcast.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, download our ebook on organic gardening basics, and get started on building your very own organic oasis today. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast today, everybody. I'm super excited because I have a guest who I have been bugging to come on the show, and he is busier than I am and raises a family and grows a ton of food and works, so he finally made time today. I said, you have to be my episode number 90. I'm not going to move your number again, which I was only joking, but he is going to be episode 90. We connected. Plus, today I've had all sorts of technology problems, and he has patiently dealt with that. And so I am super excited to introduce my guest from Canada, Tom Lampman. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you. And you are going to, I know listeners are going to love this because you have been, we've been communicating, emailing, and you've sent me great pictures and taught me some cool stuff. And so today's your day to share and teach everybody else about some of the amazing things you do up there, because you grow a lot of food in a little space and while working, and then you have a big family. So go ahead and tell listeners a little more about yourself.
Well, I can start with a long story, but that starts back in about the 1700s, so I'll give you the short story.
Okay.
Grew up in Minnesota, believe it or not, southern Minnesota. Come from a long line of German Protestant farmers. Grew up basically in a house that my dad built in the sheep pasture of my great-grandfather's farm. And it really wasn't his farm, it was actually his wife's farm, but he was a hired man, and she married him, so that's how I got located there. Went to university, met a girl from Minneapolis. What can I say? Hit it off pretty good, but we got getting a little tired of the big city life. And Minneapolis, where I went to school, was a great place. You know, lots of lakes and lots of bike trails and stuff like that, but it was an urban center, and we just, I don't know, we liked the country. We liked being out in the sticks away from people. And so a buddy of mine said, yeah, come on up to Canada, up to Winnipeg. And we'd go up there and visit, and we'd go out in the lakes and the woods, and we really loved it up there. And then the next thing I know, he said, hey, how would you like to work up here? And I said, oh, what do you got? Well, he had a job, and things came to pass that I took him up on the offer. We went up there kind of, you know, unseen, untried, and said, well, let's give it a whirl and see what happens. Well, and that's it. Never looked back after that. We've been up north, and we've been living in the sticks, or as close to the sticks as we could get, for a lot of years.
Wow. I've been here all this time. I've been thinking you're a native Canadian. So was that scary moving to Canada? Was it hard, if people are curious? Where is Winnipeg?
Well, Winnipeg is straight north of, about straight north of Grand Forks. And from Winnipeg, we were there for about 10 years, and then I was working for a big dairy processing company. They moved me out to Alberta, out to Kalmar in Alberta.
Okay. I was so, all confused here. I've been thinking, okay.
Yeah, so everybody's from someplace, Jackie.
Yeah. So, now, are you on the coast or still?
No. Nope. We're about straight north, probably pretty close to being straight north of you guys.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yeah, we're up on 153rd parallel, about 113th longitude, I believe. So we straight north of Eureka, Billings, Lethbridge, Calgary, that area.
Oh, okay, I'll have to look it up on the map again, I guess. For some reason, I thought you were over on the west coast, on the ocean.
It's too expensive to live there.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool. Well, so then do you want to tell us about your very first gardening experience? Like, who were you with? Were you a kid, an adult? Did you say you grew up on a farm?
I come from a long line of German Protestant farmers. And my first, you know, the first memories I had was digging potatoes with my great grandfather, believe it or not. I think he was about 90 years of age at the time that we were out there digging potatoes. And old farmer that had been farming for lots of years and retired, had a little post-war house that he bought with this money he'd saved over the years, and had a little garden in the backyard. And he used to take his, funny, he used to take his garbage, you know, the clippings and potato peelings and stuff, and he'd bury them in the backyard. And I never thought anything of it at the time, but now we're kind of back to that situation. I'm doing pretty much the same thing right now, except I've got a big barrel that I put all my compost in. So,
oh, you do?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Several barrels, as a matter of fact.
All right, tell us about that.
Okay, well, up here, we're kind of like the Texas of the North. Oil patch is pretty big up here. Oil, you know, the tar sands and all that kind of stuff. And so you get a lot of these old oil barrels. There's plastic ones, and they're all over the place. And being pretty frugal, I never throw anything away. I can always find a use for something.
Cool.
So what I've done is I've taken these and I've cut the tops out and the bottoms out, and drill a couple big 2-inch holes, you know, around the edges, and put all my stuff in there, grass clippings, leaves, what have you, water it down. And I've got three of them in a row, and then I just keep transferring it over there about every month or 2 months. And I got some of those, what do you call them, red wiggler worms. Mm-hmm. And I put those in there, and it's just amazing how fast those guys decompose organic waste. Just unreal. So that's what I do. And then I have another couple of big areas out back with some mesh that I put on grass clipping, corn stalks, and stuff like that. That sits there for a lot longer, but I keep rotating it and keep flipping it. It's a bit of work, but boy, it sure makes nice compost, let me tell you.
Okay, so I'm looking at the pictures you sent me. So here I'm picturing them sideways, but they're, so you cut the bottom out and the top out, and they're standing up.
Yep.
And then are they hard to turn then, or?
They can be. Like, I just scoop it out at the top, and then when it gets about half full, I just wiggle a barrel, and there's a little pile there, and I just flip that into the next one. You know, I don't go to the gym, but I use that pitchfork quite a bit, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think we're going to start a gardening CrossFit program.
Mm-hmm.
And who was it? Adam, I just talked to. His episode finally got launched yesterday. He was the one I was in the pre-interview. I was telling Tom I did all of Adam's notes, and then they disappeared on me, and I was crying. And then this friend in my podcasters group told me how I could find the last revision should have been saved, and so everything was there. But yeah, he was talking about we should have like a contest, an event where everybody would get together and we'd have like gardening CrossFit challenges, like who can, you know, lift the most compost with their pitchfork or something, or throw it the furthest, or I don't know. He had a bunch of great ideas. So, and Kelly Ware's talked a lot about gardening CrossFit. So,
nothing to prove to anybody. I don't worry about things like that. I'll leave the contest up to somebody stronger.
Yeah. Well, he's still just a young kid, you know, in college and all. So tell us, what does organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening mean to you then?
Well, I guess where we live here, we live right in black soil country. We got some of the best soil in North America right here. And we're surrounded by pretty much big commercial farms. Like the neighbor right next door in the next quarter over, I think he farms about 5,000 acres. The guy across the road, he does about 1,000 acres. So, you know, it's a pretty commercially industrial type agriculture around here. And everybody uses sprays, you know, there's Roundup Ready this, Roundup Ready that, there's fungicides, there's foliar sprays, all that kind of stuff. So it's really expensive to do that. And I look at all the equipment and I look at all of the costs, and being a frugal German, again, I try to keep things inexpensive. If I can use stuff right around the acreage here, then that's what I use. Why go out and buy something when you can make it at home just as cheaply?
Mm-hmm. Now, do you want to tell us about your family a little? And because you have quite a few kids, right?
What's that again?
You have quite a few kids, right, that you feed?
Yes. We're gonna be a typical, you know, suburban family, two kids and place in town, but just never struck us the right way. So we bought a little acreage years ago out in the country, and put a mobile home on it because we said, well, let's just put something fairly inexpensive and cheap, and then later on we'll build a house. Well, we lived in that mobile home for 17 years. So it wasn't really all that temporary, but we had kids that came every 4 years, and by the end I had five kids, and we had the kids stacked up like cordwood in the mobile. So anyway, we finally did get around to building. We built a two-story garage. We lived there, and then we built the house, and you know, to make a long story a little bit shorter, voila, that's where we are. Now most of the kids are getting to that stage of life where they've left home. And now mom and I are just sitting there looking at each other in this huge garden and tons of food and 400 pounds of potatoes and 15 squash. You know, it's once you have a garden, you garden it. You grow stuff. You know, I don't want to sit there and mow grass all the time. So, but the thing is that even the grass I do have around here, you know, I make that work for me as well. Normally here you'll get a big rush of dandelions early spring. And what I normally do is I let those go to bloom, and that way it brings in the bees like you wouldn't believe. I get bumblebees and honeybees and all types of pollinators. When they get to be about 10% white, then I go in and I mow it. And I always mow it with the highest setting. And then I take all of those grass clippings and they go into the major piles and water them down, and they heat up, and I got old leaves from the previous years. I mix those in there, and boy, that stuff heats up and it decomposes like within about 2-3 weeks. Just beautiful stuff. So, and then I, you know, once the dandelions are mowed, I'll mow it maybe once or twice during the summer. And then the clover starts blooming. So I let that go pretty much until it's 50% bloom. And the bees will come in and work that over. And when it's just starting to shrivel up, and I go in and I mow it again, and that all goes in the compost pile as well. So, you know, I can have 6-7 yards, cubic yards of compost when I do that, and that all eventually ends up in the garden.
Yeah, sometimes it's amazing how fast compost can turn into black soil. You know, it doesn't take as long as some people think.
I think the important thing is that you, whenever you use that compost, never work it into your soil. And the reason for that, of course, is it sucks nitrogen out of the ground really fast to break that down. All those little critters will use nitrogen up to build protein, and that is usually the problem when people dig their compost. And if it's not 100% decomposed and aged, it will actually rob the soil of nitrogen. So what I do with my compost is I put it on top, and I let the rain and the showers wash any nutrients that are in there into the soil.
I think that's what we do too. So maybe that's why it works good like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think if you look around on the internet, there's a lot of gardening places. I think the trend is going that way. Mm-hmm. More and more people go to the no-till. You know, I've watched my neighbors around here who always talk about no-till, and they rely on sprays to do it, but they're usually in there with a, you know, chisel plow or something like that, getting it ready for seeding. And that's always bugged me. I said, you know, why are they spend all that money on chemicals, and then they're out there ripping the soil up, knocking the heck out of the worms and all the microbiological life that's in the soil. And it just doesn't seem to make sense to me. And I guess that's where I've gotten to be with organic farming is, why go out and spend all that money? You know, when I look at the guys around me, they're all sitting on about $1 million worth of equipment, and you know, the payments to make that stuff and the fuel, it's just not ecologically right, really, you know. Mm-hmm. Nature does such a wonderful job of growing food for us. You know, all you have to do is put a seed in the ground and it grows and produces quite a bit. Why do you need all the chemicals and all that other stuff?
I don't know. I mean, I hear things like, oh, then there'd be too many weeds and, you know, different things. But to me, it just seems like, well, but you're spending all that money on the chemicals, like you said, putting it in there, and it just can't be good for the planet. And it just, I don't know, it can't be good, I think, on our food. Like, either if you're spraying it on the roots or putting it down deep into the soil, or if you're spraying your apples or whatever you're putting it on, to me, it just, I don't know, why would you want to eat that? It'd be worth it, the extra labor, if there is extra labor.
You know, you can look at it from a couple different points. I look at it from a financial point, that why spend that money? Like, I said this to the neighbor the other day. I was kind of joking, and my son was with me, and he commented about, gee, do you own all this land? He says, yeah, I own it, but he says, I'm just a hired man around here. I'm still working for the chemical companies. I'm working for the bank. I'm working for the equipment companies. He says, I'm a peasant. I know I'm a peasant. My family's always been peasants. We've always farmed. So he says, that really doesn't change. It's just somebody else has got their hand in your pocket. So, and
yeah,
he's right.
That doesn't make any sense.
He is right to a certain degree. I think once you get attached to the soil and you're working the soil, you do become a peasant, because basically you have to sell your products to other people. And there's always going to be a speculator in between, jacking the price up of what you've produced for somebody else. That's the old middleman thing, eh?
Yeah, unless you're selling like CSA shares or to like the farmer's market, right?
Well, that's a different story too. You know,
but the big
and that
commercial
a,
guys don't do that.
Yeah, I've had a lot of people say that, you know, gee, Tom, with all that produce, you should sell it. And I said, well, you know, I've tried that a few times, and I just have this thing, I don't know, maybe it's that German Protestant background. You know, to take a head of lettuce and sell it to somebody and get a, up here we have the toonie coin, it's a $2 coin. I, you know, here I am exchanging something that's come out of the ground, and Mother Nature has provided for me free of charge, and I'm giving it to another person, and they're giving me this little piece of metal back. Like, it just doesn't, just doesn't relate. I would sooner give it to the food bank. I take a lot of stuff to church for the seniors. To me, you know, I just put the sweat equity into it. I'm not expecting to get rich. You know, I'm at that stage of life where I got the house paid off and all that kind of stuff. So do I need a lot more? I don't think so. That's just my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, that's where kind of like I get, you know, we're not growing enough to sell CSA. Like, to me, I thought this year I was like, how much are we going to have to grow to be able to sell, you know, 50 or 100 CSA shares to make a living off of this garden? I can't even imagine it. But, you know, maybe we just, you know, it's only was our first year this year just trying to even see what we could grow. But yeah, and a lot of times I'm like, you know, I have a little bit extra here and a little bit extra there, but it's sometimes it's not even worth the gas money to run into town to try to find somebody to even give it to you.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, Jack.
And then it seems like the day I am going to town, I'm in a rush and, you know, it's not food pantry day or it's not the right day. And I don't know. But cool. All right. Well, so then do you want to tell us who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques?
Well, I guess I go back to my earliest upbringings. Like I said, I grew up in Minnesota in a hardwood forest. We had oak trees around and walnut trees, and we had chestnuts. I know my dad used to complain chestnuts would get in there, and if he had the power mower, would fire those things around the yard. But again, we grew up right where my great-grandparents basically farmed, and they lived right in the middle of this area. And of course, after World War II, they started subdividing all this land because, you know, all the soldiers were coming home. And so I grew up around familiar haunts, apple trees that we still collected apples from. And we never used any pesticides and stuff back then. We just picked what was there. And if it had a few worms in it, well, we didn't eat it, you know. Like they always joke, you know, what's worse than finding a worm in your apple? Finding half a worm. So it's one of those things that, you know, We just, it was what we grew up with, and we quite enjoyed it. And, you know, what are you going to do? It's, that was my background. And then, of course, on my mom's side, my great-grandfather was a German. Matter of fact, the first words I ever spoke were German, because he had come over from Germany with his folks. He was born 2 days after Lincoln was shot. So that shows you how old, you know, what kind of a generational divide there was between him and myself. So, but again, that was just what I knew. That's what was in front of me. And I try to do that with my grandkids. They come out here and they run around the garden and they just, it's like an Easter egg hunt when they're out there picking raspberries or, ooh, look, we found some strawberries. You know, I think that's really critical nowadays is to get young kids out into the world and out into gardens.
I agree.
That's where those first connections are made. And if you don't do it then, I don't know. To have your grandkids sitting there working his iPad or his Game Boy or whatever just doesn't fit for me. Of course, I'm old-fashioned. What can I say?
And they can do that in the dark.
Yeah.
There's plenty of dark.
Absolutely.
When you can't be outside anyway, they can do that. Yeah. And when my grandkids come up, they love it. They always have a blast. They, you know, want to pick the carrots or, you know, harvest the green beans, or they always want to help. They always have fun. So, and lots of my guests have always said that's how they learned. That's how they got inspired was with their grandparents.
When you're digging potatoes, I know my little grandson, I said, come on, now you grab a hold of the top of the plant here and I'll put the pitchfork underneath. And of course his eyes just get really big. Ooh, look at the potatoes, you know. Mm-hmm. To make that connection early in life is very, very important because there's a lot of kids out there that they don't even know where milk comes from. They think it comes from the store. There's no connection with their food. And I think that's what we've lost with the industrialization of agriculture in this country. But maybe I'm an old reactionary conservative. I don't know.
No, I don't think so at all. I think a lot of us are saying that. And just like last week, I had an educator on, an amazing woman, Patty Armbruster. And she taught in a school. And when she first got there, she was like, what? You kids don't know where potatoes come from. You don't know that potatoes grow in the ground. And so she, you know, has been passionately working to change that. And then she was upset about the food that they were eating in the school cafeteria, that there was no local meat in Montana where we have tons of cattle and the meat's coming from Texas. And so she's changed that. So they're getting their meat locally and
things like that.
So,
I don't get on the internet and listen to your podcast enough. I'm going to have to go back and listen to that one.
Yeah, she was just, I think, last Thursday's episode.
Okay.
Really, really just an amazing woman, what she's done in, and she's like in Hinsdale, which is this itty bitty tiny community in Montana. And she's just making huge changes there that are spreading not just across our state, but I think are going to spread nationally eventually.
Yeah.
And, kids definitely need to be connected to our land and learn more about where our food grows and eating healthier foods. And I think we all want that. And it's just trying to figure out how we're going to get there and how to, build those connections and get the food into our cafe. Like she went through some big battles to get locally raised beef. Like, because especially there where there's like kids in the school whose parents are cattle farmers, and they were like, well, we'll just donate the meat. And even that wouldn't work because of the processing and this and that. You know, they were like, we'll donate a cow. But then by the time they processed it and did all of that, that didn't work out. So they ended up, finding a processor in Montana. So they're not processing their own cows, but at least they're getting meat that's made in Montana, and they had to change a little bit of their buying structure so they could afford it, because it's pretty expensive to buy meat that's actually produced in Montana. How ridiculous that is.
Yeah, well, you got to start small and you got to start local, and I think that's one of the real movements behind the local food is it tastes better, it's convenient, it's close to you. It, like I say, strawberries fresh out of the garden taste a lot better than ones trucked in from California. That's for sure.
She said the same thing. Okay. So do you want to share with us how you learned how to garden organically? I know you had sent me an email and said a little bit about reading Rodale's and different things. Go ahead. You tell us. I'll be quiet.
I think part of it is that those early experiences kind of through osmosis. Mm-hmm. And I also sometimes wonder if it isn't a cultural and a genetic thing. Because I come from a long line of farmers, and most of the people that settled North America, you know, a good number of them early on, like my ancestors came over in 1700. So they've been farming all their lives right from then. They left Germany so they could find land in the New World. And like I said, I can count on my hands and toes all the farmers in my family. So maybe there is a connection there. I did actually buy Rodale's book back in the 60s, you know, the little Basic Book of Organic Gardening. I think I still got the original copy up in the shelves, and I used to refer to that on seeding dates and stuff. And of course, living this far north, I always had to adjust things a little bit due to the climatic conditions up here, which can be brutal sometimes. But you live to learn. You live to learn about your environment and the geography that you're in, and then tailor make your gardening to the climate. And that's very important. You have to know your environment and your geography to really be successful.
Ooh, excellent tips there. Okay. Well, how about, do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year?
Everything this year. I was surprised. We had that early drought from about May right up until the end of June. We had very little rain. We had one rain shower, and I managed through that one rain shower to fill up about, oh, I think we filled up about a dozen barrels. Those are 50-gallon barrels that I have stored behind the garage. Oh. And that was just enough water to kind of get most of my crops watered once during that dry spell, because you started to see the plants slowing down. You could see they were starting to go dormant. Mm-hmm. And I hit them with that water, and I really, really soaked the area, and they sprung right back. And then we finally got some rains in July. And after that, I tell you, my pruning shears was going like crazy just to cut stuff back. It was wild. And funny, because the commercial farmers around here too, everybody was singing the blues. A couple of the areas around here have gone into an emergency situation. Agricultural aid and all that, they were worried really bad. And then all of a sudden the rains came, and they came just at the perfect time. And again, like the neighbor here, he just had a bumper crop of barley. I couldn't believe it. He broke a record. He said that he's never grown so much barley as it was this year. And it was the same thing with me. I have cucumbers. I couldn't give away enough cucumbers. The neighbor said you should put some in a bag and put them on people's steps and ring the doorbell and take off. And, you know, I didn't get to that point, but I felt like it because I didn't want to throw the stuff all in the compost heap. Mm-hmm. And everybody at church was they were starting to get familiar with me. Oh, here comes Tom. He's got some more potatoes and lettuce. But that's it. Like I said, I haven't had to work for it. Mother Nature has put all that stuff in my plate. So why not share it with other people? Yes.
Okay.
You can only be charitable if you got an abundance, and that's what we had this year. Pumpkins and corn. I had the best corn ever. Normally, this far north, you got to be really careful about when you put the corn in. I normally sprout my seeds in a jar and then I plant them. But boy, the rains came just at the perfect time. We had a bumper crop of corn, good sweet corn. We had corn right up until about the middle of September. I couldn't believe it. Never had corn like that before.
So when did you start harvesting it then?
About that first week of August.
Wow.
It got really hot. Normally it doesn't get that hot, but it got pretty doggone hot, and that corn just took off. It was like, normally we were worried about it because you've heard the old thing, knee high by the 4th of July?
Yeah.
Well, it was about ankle high by about the 15th of June. I'm saying, holy smokes, what's going to happen? But by the 4th of July, it was knee high. I couldn't believe it. It just took right off. And we had a lot of heat. So heat and sunlight makes a big difference.
And,
living this far north, the other thing, too, is you get a lot more light. And people don't realize it.
Right.
In the morning, the sun's up at about 4:30 in the morning, and it sets around 10:30 at night. So you get a lot of extra light, and that extra light really makes things sweeter. The corn was just super sweet this year. The peas were super sweet. It's producing a lot of those sugars through the sunlight. So we're lucky to have that extra sunlight. We don't get the heat, but we don't. This year we did get enough heat at the right time that we did get the corn to ripen. But again, even the tomatoes didn't get ripe because we don't have really warm evenings. Mm-hmm. We'll have maybe some nights be 5 or 6 degrees, maybe 40, 42 at night. And you really need above 50 degree temperatures in order to get, good ripening of tomatoes. That's 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Up here in Canada, we're metric, so we got to go back and forth between the two.
Well, you have that right down. I couldn't, go back and forth that easy at all. You grew up on Fahrenheit, right?
Well, yeah, I've had both. I worked in the dairy industry for a good 40 years, So you had to be able to go back and forth between liters and gallons and metric imperial gallons and American gallons. And so you had to know your stuff, and that just kind of built in, something you had to learn.
Oh, okay. Well, I like that tip that you have to have 50 degrees temperature for tomatoes, that's part of it. And yeah, people don't really, like even my parents, when they've come to visit, they're like, I remember one of the first, they're like, it's the first night, their last night here was like the first night they had seen the stars, because it was like the first night they were just so tired, they finally went to bed after dark. And they were like, yep, we didn't even realize how late it's been staying light out. And just when you come in June, most people don't realize, like, and you get tired. I remember I used to like have the hardest time trying to get Mike just to come in to have dinner before it got dark. And I'd be like, I don't want to cook dinner at 11.
Where has my wife heard this story before? Yeah.
All right. Well, how about, so is there something you're excited to try next year?
I'm excited to try something every year. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. This year, well, actually it was last year, I planted Jerusalem artichokes. And as far as I'm concerned, those particular things are like a weed. they're from the aster plant, or aster family, and they grow to be about 8 feet tall, and they make a big tuber on the bottom, which is kind of it's kind of like a potato, not that big, a bit of a nutty flavor to it. A lot of work to peel them and get them ready to eat, but once you get them growing in your garden, watch out, because you can't get all those little tubers and they keep coming up. So if you're going to grow them, make sure you've got a spot that is kind of out in the edge or away from the main garden. The other thing is asparagus. Asparagus grows really well here, but don't ever make sure that you plant it in one place, because if you ever have to move one of those things, you better either have a backhoe or dynamite, because those roots go down to China.
Really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So if you're going to grow the stuff, or if you're going to give some away to somebody, make sure that they grow it in a spot that's going to be a perennial bed, something that'll be there for a lot of years, because it'll produce really good. But it does take up a bit of room, and whether you get, you know, the abundance from an asparagus plant, we love asparagus in the spring. It's just beautiful stuff, and then it goes to seed. So it doesn't produce on a per acre tonnage basis that much, but it's like, I guess it's like strawberries. It, you know, you don't get a huge volume of strawberries. Well, I shouldn't say that. We did this year, but you have to kind of pace yourself on what your garden is going to be appointed to, or what you're going to put in that area. And you got to use your head a little bit and do some planning. There's no question about it.
Yep, that's been my biggest lesson, is that I need to plan more next year, like in January. I need to really figure out where, what's going to go where, what seeds I'm going to buy, and really, might be the other one is I want to make sure I plan like spreading them out. Like I'm going to plant some this week and next week, and like what day is going to be planting day, and then stick to it.
Yeah, and that's critical too. You've got to kind of plan that. We're still taking spinach and lettuce out of the garden. And we've had two pretty hard frosts here, but we just covered up. Mm-hmm. And, of course, spinach and lettuce is really resilient, and it bounces right back.
And so, it almost likes the cooler, don't you think?
Absolutely, yeah. You don't want the heat for that stuff, because it forces it to seed. And, of course, we had that this summer. But we planted some here the second week of August, and we're eating that now. So you can do it if you plan properly. That's critical. And the other thing... Yeah. The other thing I was going to mention, you'd mentioned that about where you put stuff. Mm-hmm. For some reason, I save my own seeds, and I got a few pumpkin seeds in with my zucchini squash.
Oh.
Not my zucchini, the spaghetti squash, pardon me. The spaghetti squash. And what happened is I've got some pumpkins that look like spaghetti squash and some spaghetti squash that look like pumpkins.
Oh, interesting.
So the two were too close to each other. And like I said, we've got lots of pollinators. The bees work that stuff over. So I think I got a little bit of cross-pollinization there. The stuff tasted okay, but it wasn't really true to its form as such. So if you're going to have a pumpkin patch, make sure it's a pumpkin patch, and make sure that your spaghetti squash is... where the spaghetti squash needs to grow, and you know, try to put something in between like beans or corn or anything like that, because there is some of that cross-pollinization.
That's a great tip. I forgot what I was going to say. I'll think of it in a second, I'm sure. Okay. Tell us about something that didn't work so well this season.
You know, I'm having a rough time. I think the thing that didn't work all that well this year was the raspberries, and not because they didn't grow. It was because of some certain four-footed friends of ours that managed to jump the fence every night. And unfortunately, I didn't produce enough of everything to keep them happy. So they came over and visited me on a regular basis and nibbled down the tops of my raspberry bushes. So my raspberry harvest was cut back a little bit. However, having said that, I got kind of a second blossom of raspberries later on. Normally you get raspberries coming in like gangbusters around the 1st of August, but we actually got some towards the end of August that we normally wouldn't have, because I think they pruned them back. And of course, when you prune something back like that, it forces it to go to seed. Mm-hmm. And so we got some raspberries that we really didn't expect to have at that time of the year.
That's what I was going to say, was that I have spinach right now that came up from my spinach that bolted in the spring or the summer, you know, like end of June, yep, early July. And it just came back on its own, but it's like really good, and it's coming up nice.
Oh, and that cool weather, yeah, and that sunlight. Yeah, absolutely. I've been very fortunate.
So it's been the best spinach I've had all year is what's growing right now. Yeah.
I hear you.
All right, so Tom, tell us about something that you find is easy to grow and generally successful every time.
Spuds, no two ways about it. Potatoes, I've never really had a problem. And I guess the one thing is, because we have really good soil here, we've got black soil, it's about 3 feet deep.
We've never
really had a problem as far as fertility goes. Usually it's the weather, it's the freak frost. We sometimes will get a frost June the 8th. We can get frost as early as September the 8th. Mm-hmm. So in the year that you've only got 90 days of frost-free growing, it can be a little challenging. Mm-hmm. But we do have some covers that we put over stuff if we're threatening. Like our tomatoes, we've got a cover that we can put over that if we have to. But in rain, if it gets too wet and cool, then you get the mold, you get slugs, you get all that kind of stuff. I guess a warm, dry year sometimes is better than a wet year because of those issues. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, everything grew pretty good this year. I really can't complain. It's been just an excellent year. Cool. So, I you know, if something, usually it's insects or, well, not so much insects. Insects seem to be not a problem for me. It's the critters, pocket gophers, deer, that kind of stuff caused me the biggest aggravation. When we were raising chickens, you'd always get an occasional weasel or skunk that would come in, and, you know, occasional fox or coyote. But, you know, we're far enough out in the country that we're still going to get that stuff. And you got to kind of roll with the punches with that stuff.
We've had a lot of skunks in our area this year. I've heard people talking. My dog gets, I don't know, he just can't seem to learn. It's like every 2 weeks he gets skunked.
Yep.
All right. Well, how about something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
Boy, I guess I wouldn't steer anybody away from trying something. Mm-hmm. You learn more by your failures than you do by your successes, as far as I'm concerned. Mother Nature is very resilient, and she gives you an abundance every year. So it's in the lean years that you probably learn the most about gardening. So that's the only advice, sound advice. I guess that's advice I get from Mother Nature. She teaches me a lot.
You know, and I think that's true. And I've heard that from a lot of people, like, you know, that, or one thing that's really kind of stood out to me is that, you know, when you garden, something's going to grow really well. Some things are going to not do what you thought they would, but overall, more often than not, you're going to be more successful than less successful. You know, something might not come out the way you want it to. You might have a couple of things that don't grow or produce as much as you thought. But generally, most people, you know, get a pretty good yield from just trying. Something's going to work great.
I know my grandfather used to say, if you don't plant a garden, you're not going to eat.
Nice. Right? Yeah, it's kind of changed since then, but...
And you can grow, an awful lot of food.
Yeah.
Right in a small space, if you want to do, take the time and the effort to do it. That's what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm. And there, it's not even all that much of an effort. You know, like some strategic planning can make a huge difference in how much you can produce with a lot less effort than if you kind of go haywire like I would. Just throw seeds in the ground and think they're either going to grow or not really planning. So
that's right. And you look at the guys that farm around here, their livelihoods depend on it. And yeah, they have crop insurance and stuff like that. I don't have crop insurance, and I guess I don't have to rely on my garden. However, we're at the stage of life where, gosh, I really don't buy too much from the store. I think toilet paper and plastic bags are about it. Other than a jug of milk occasionally because I don't have a cow.
Wow. All right. Well, we're not anywhere near there. I feel like I'm at the grocery store like every day. But I do feel the thing I buy the most at the grocery store is dog and cat food. So yep. We do grow quite a bit of food. Okay.
Yeah, we have a rule around here that if you can't put it in the freezer, I usually don't raise it.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah, so except for a couple of cats. You got to have a couple of cats to keep the mice down. That's it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you mean you don't have dogs?
No,
if you
we
can't
used to
put
have
it
dogs,
in the freezer, that's what you mean?
No, I don't put dogs in the freezer, Jackie.
Yeah, so you don't have a dog because you don't put it in the freezer? Is that what you mean?
No, we don't. We used to have dogs, but again, when you're living off the land like that, you have animals around that are going to contribute to the lifestyle there. And if I had sheep many years ago, and we had a dog then, a herding dog, and he earned his keep. But a cat that doesn't catch mice is not really worth a lot as far as I'm concerned. a dog that eats your dog food, it's nice to have a dog around for companion, but when you have five kids, do you really need another companion?
Right.
Yeah. So again, maybe I'm just too frugal and too pragmatic. That could be part of it too. Again, like I said, I don't throw anything away. I'm recycling everything. I've got more junk around here than I really need, but I can always find a use for something somewhere.
Cool. I like that. I got lots of junk too. But we do use a lot of it. And you know, and then if it does end up having to get thrown out after it's been sitting in the yard for 5 or 10 years or something, you know, but at least we tried. But we definitely reuse and recycle way more than the ordinary person. And
absolutely.
I think, you know, yeah, I agree with that. I don't like the wasting attitude a lot of people have. Just throw it away or pass it on. Or I mean, passing it on is good, but just, I don't know. Okay. How about, do you have a least favorite activity to do in the garden? Anything you got to force yourself to get out there and do?
There aren't too many. The only one that I really hate is weeding when the mosquitoes are bad. I don't mind weeding because I can throw all that stuff back into a compost pile and I know it's going back into the soil eventually. Mm-hmm. But boy, when the mosquitoes get bad around here, you don't want to be outside. You feel like you got to get carried away and that can be a real pain. Mm-hmm. But there isn't too many duties in the garden that I don't enjoy. I look at it from the physical fitness standpoint. Stay active. Keep moving. A lot of senior people are in retirement homes, and they're there because they don't move. When you live in the country, you're always moving. You're always picking something. You're always putting something away. You're picking this up, raking leaves, sawing up logs, cutting wood for the wood stove. You're always doing something. You're always going, and that's important. Stay busy. Stay mobile.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah, Mike's really been, like, cleaning up the trees and stuff and making, you know, picking up all the brush and the undergrowth and kind of, like, you know, reducing the fire danger, especially after our fires this year. And also, like, we're thinking about getting sheep. So do you have any, like, we want to get sheep for wool. Do you have any suggestions for what kind of sheep would be good for wool? Did you have wool sheep or sheep that you eat?
We came into sheep quite by accident. We have neighbors down the road. She's from Australia originally. Mm-hmm. And they raise sheep. And we used to get their lambs, orphan lambs, and so we'd raise them. And it was getting to the point where they grow up and then they have babies. And I only got like 3 acres of grass there. Well, you know, you have 2 sheep and you'll have 6 sheep real soon if you breed them. And so I've got wool. We take all of our wool, all the wool that we used to have when we raised sheep, down to Carstairs, Alberta. They have a big woolen mill down there, and they process it and put it into wool, yarn. And I've got 4 bags in the basement right now that are all filled with yarn that I got from about 6 years ago. And I got enough wool to knit sweaters until I'm 95. They produced a lot of wool.
Really? So what kind of sheep were they? Because we've been trying to figure out, like, what's the best kind of sheep to get for wool?
They're pretty much a white face. I had 2 Suffolk, and I had it was a Polypay cross. You can get a lot of different breeds. They have different types of wool. Mm-hmm. But Suffolk wool, they'll produce a lot of it. They'll produce a good carcass as well for meat. So as far as I'm concerned, Suffolk is probably the best way to go. But they're a big animal, and they take your grass right down to the roots. So they can really beat up a pasture pretty fast. So you have to be careful. You've got to continually rotate the pasture if you're going to do that.
Okay. Cool. Okay. Nobody's really talked about that yet, and I've been wondering, and we've kind of tried to look into it a little, but haven't come up with much. So
read as much as you can, Jackie. That's the most important thing. Get online, get books, and read as much as you can, because you'll learn a lot raising sheep, but you can avoid a lot of mistakes by getting educated.
Okay. What's the biggest mistake to avoid?
Pasture management. As with all agriculture where you're raising animals, you have to know how much grass those cows are going to eat. And if you don't get the rains when you normally expect them, then you got to find feed. You got to bring feed in. Very, very important.
Okay.
You got to know what your land can provide.
I don't know anything about that. But my kid, they had like dairy cows when he was a kid, but they had a pretty big ranch too. So I don't know. He probably knows a little more than I do, but...
I used to be a field man for the dairy, so I know a lot about dairy cows as well. So it's managing that feed is the most important thing. And this year with the dry weather in the spring, mm-hmm. There were a lot of guys suffered because they had to buy hay and had to bring it in. Very expensive. So it can be a good year. At the same time, it can be a bad year for somebody else that's raising cattle.
Oh, okay. Cool. Okay. Hear the rest of my interview with Tom Lampman in part 2 of episode 90 of the Organic Gardener Podcast. Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow.